Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
Okay. I want to get this started. Now, I have to tell you that I'm deeply honored to stand here to moderate the Carbon 14 discussion, but I'm obviously not really qualified to contribute much to it other than maybe some general basic knowledge. So I'm going to depend on some of the people that are here that are far more knowledgeable about C14 and the dating of the shroud to actively participate, and Joe will have the microphone. But when Bill sent me this, he said, now look, he says, I can't be there, but I wanted to send a message. And so if everybody's ready and everybody's rolling their tapes, Alan, you're ready to roll and everybody's ready? You're okay, because I'm going to go ahead and punch this up. You might want to get this on tape, Alan, because it's Bill being Bill. And anybody that knows Bill knows what that means. So here is, and if all goes well, we'll hear it, a message from Bill Meacham. Now, he gave me this PowerPoint, and I'm just going to go ahead and go through it, because it's perhaps going through it, we stop at each one, and perhaps this will give us the points for discussion. So, do I need to read these aloud? Should I? Okay. The conundrum, then. Preponderance of evidence indicates the shroud is not medieval, but from antiquity. C14 dating is the only significant evidence against that conclusion. The assumption that the shroud is indeed from Roman times and around 2,000 years old, a hypothesis that most shroud researchers would agree with. How then to explain the C14 date? Several scenarios have been proposed, and these can be grouped into three broad categories. One, natural factors such as contamination, isotope exchange, or repair. Two, a supernatural event, the resurrection, having an impact on the cloth's C14 content. And three, conspiracy theories involving switching of samples. The question was, did they screw up and cut the wrong piece? And that would be under... I guess I would put that under natural factors, because there was nothing supernatural about that, so I would assume that would be considered natural. So now he goes through the scenarios. Resurrection scenario of the strengths, it allows for unknown or extremely rare processes like radiation, coronal discharge, neutron bombardment. Was he here? Meacham, was he here today? That might have enriched the C14 content of the cloth, giving it a younger radiocarbon age than its actual age. And the weaknesses of the theory are, thanks, Bill, appeal to, you pronounce it for me, there's somebody here from... Thank you very much. Outside the scope of science, also the striking and unlikely coincidence of the C14 date with the first well-documented historical appearance of the shroud. The contamination scenarios. The strengths are known as a general problem in C14 dating, a long history of the cloth in different environments. The weaknesses, large amount of contaminant as a percentage of the sample, 50% or more would be necessary, should have been detected with the array of tests the cloth has been subjected to. The isotope exchange theory. The strength is it provides a credible, in theory, avenue for enrichment of the C14 in the cloth. And the weaknesses is it has not been demonstrated experimentally. Insufficient available carbon, for example, in the air, to substantially alter the C14-C12 ratio in the cloth. The repair-reweave hypothesis. Strengths, a credible explanation of the late C-14 date, and anomalies in the test area tested. The weaknesses, doubt about the feasibility of even expert reweavers to produce a truly invisible repair that would escape close examination by textile experts. Too bad he wasn't here today. Absence of any historically proven examples of such a reweave. And by the way, if we can find another one of those books, we should send one to Bill, the invisible reweaving book. Conspiracy theories. Strengths can explain the erroneous date, inconsistencies in data recorded at the sample taking and at the labs. The weaknesses, it requires unlikely collaboration of many parties, impugns the integrity of scholars that were involved, and there's no clear motive for it, which I think makes good sense. Ah, and he changes the color on us to point out that nothing can be ruled out. It is important to note that none of the scenarios described above can be definitively ruled out. The conspiracy and resurrection theories, by their nature, would be almost impossible to falsify. Of the three natural scenarios, the reweave hypothesis appears to have the most support at present. Okay. Apparently, Dan Scone liked that. But nothing is proven either. The reweave hypothesis has major problems and has been rejected as impossible by several textile experts. Several or one?
One.
Ironically, it is the easiest by far of the three scenarios to prove or disprove simply by dating other samples from elsewhere on the cloth. Makes sense. Testing for contamination, any new sample should be thoroughly scrutinized prior to dating. Three samples from different parts of the cloth would reduce to almost nil the possibility of heavy, undetectable contamination across the entire cloth. So, and testing for isotope exchange, similarly, it is unlikely that a massive isotope exchange could have occurred across the entire cloth. Sampling should focus on a charred to scorched to pristine area to examine the possibility of heat-related enrichment. In sum, in bright pink, Bill has a great sense of humor. For those who don't know him, this should be pretty good evidence. The C-14 date remains a huge problem for proponents of the shroud's authenticity. There are relatively straightforward tests that can be done to confirm or rebut the original dating. The church has thus far been unwilling to provide any samples for such tests, and the matter has, incredibly, remained in limbo for the last 20 years. What can be done? Perhaps a resolution passed by acclamation at this conference, calling for new C-14 dating to test the three main scenarios to be sent to Turin and the Vatican? Question mark by Bill. And that's it. That's what Bill gave us. So, I'm not quite sure how to proceed, other than I'm sure there are people who have opinions on all of these various scenarios. And I think maybe one of the frustrations that I have in having to stand here in place of Bill is if Bill had been here, he might have wanted to amend some of his comments today.
I think that's the big thing, Barry, is that Bill was not here.
Oh, yeah. Well, if we're going to... Sure.
I'm sorry, but maybe it's because I'm really tired and I have to get to the point on things. But I think the problem is that Bill wasn't.
Right.
And I think a lot of this stuff is superfluous. Discussions about, and the fact is, and Bob knows my favorite thing to say now is, you know, if you want orange juice, you have to squeeze an orange. You don't squeeze an apple. And basically what was tested was a cotton sample. And if that wasn't made clear today, then, you know, that's...
Then I don't know what.
I don't know what.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe.
I have a question. I wasn't really clear on this earlier, and perhaps other people weren't either. Los Alamos results today, did they reflect the fact that the actual threat that was subjected to carbon-14 dating was a reweave, or did they reflect the fact that another threat in that batch someplace was a reweave? Which is the answer?
I think that the answer is that another threat in that area proved to be anomalous in cotton.
Okay.
Because the original carbon dating protocol and Paul Maloney or someone more knowledgeable might correct me if I'm wrong, the original protocol called for chemical analysis of the samples before they were destroyed in the carbon dating process.
That's correct.
Okay. The three laboratories chose not to do that chemical analysis. And I remember when Luigi Ganella was asked why, the answer was expediency, which was the most phenomenally amazing answer I've ever heard when you're dealing with the, perhaps the most important relic of Christianity, that suddenly expediency becomes the priority. But in the end, what I found out, if I may, just this last point, that they could not find another herringbone weave to give them as a control sample, so they could all look at the samples and know which one, the one, only one they got that was herringbone weave had to be the shroud. So they said because of that, they really didn't need to do chemical analysis. But, you know, I'm not a chemist, so somebody who knows more about it than I do might speak up. But as far as I'm concerned, you can't do chemistry with your eyes. Walter McCrone tried, and look where it got him. And so I personally think that one of the great flaws in the radiocarbon dating was the fact that they didn't follow their own protocol.
So we're making an inference, nevertheless, protocol or not, we're making an inference here that the date was in doubt because another sample in the same batch
adjacent
was adjacent to it, was, but not necessarily that.
Well, remember that in Rogers' thermochemic active paper, he had a piece of the actual reserve cut for radiocarbon dating.
Yes.
He had an actual reserve. It was consistent with all of the things he found, and we saw today about the rates. Consistent. In other words,
I have to say something after, but I wanted to say now something about the presentation of Barry. There was written that 14C is a problem for us now. For me, it is not a problem because the statistical analysis are wrong. There are errors in the natural report. I have underlined them in my sheet that indicate that the dating is not acceptable. And this calculation comes not from me, but from many other researchers that demonstrate that these results are not acceptable from a statistical point of view.
Julio,
this is the point.
Can I ask you a question? If they had done the chemical analysis as their own protocol called for, is it possible that they might have discovered that this was actually not linen or that there was contamination of cotton with, mixed with the linen? Had
this
they
is
done
the proof. The results show for the moment that the sample was contaminated. By water, I don't know. We must discover.
You we say we don't know. Well, the point is, the dates are irrelevant.
We do know, Julio. We do know what it was contaminated by. The fact is, whether or not you want to accept that, that's the issue. The whole dating point of the 1260 to 1390, the fact that the statistics, it doesn't matter because you were dating an apple and you were trying to date an orange. So it doesn't, it's inconsistent.
Just take the microphone. Oh.
I wanted to show.
Sure. This isn't 20 minutes, right?
Yes. Only to show.
Not 20 minutes. Too much. We only have an hour and a half.
Because this is an important point of view.
Okay. Just as, not a long lecture. This is supposed to be discussion. We're working on it, Phil.
Let's do this.
Which one?
C14
new? C14.
Yes.
Normal?
New.
Normal.
New.
Normal.
Bravo.
I know a little bit.
Thank you. We jump the first part that it is printed in the paper. And I want... The questions I wanted to underline have been sent to Michael Tait. Obviously, no answer. If no clarifying answer will be obtained, a new radiocarbon date is necessary. at least part of the 14th sea area was not a medieval patch, as you see here, but because of the old water stain. But as you well know, here is the area that it was dated, and here is a sample at the Fondazione Traemme that it perhaps can be dated. If we want, we have the access probably to this sample. It is very interesting because if we see jump this and this, this is the sample dated, Oxford, Zurich and Arizona, and these are a possible disposition of the results. We see that we have 200 difference between Oxford and Arizona. This is well in agreement with Walsh data that you well know, that are not compatible each other. You can well see that this result is not compatible with this. And only this is the demonstration, the statistical demonstration, that there is the sample is not homogeneous. There is a contamination, a reweaving, another thing, we don't know, but there is a contamination.
Yes, but so, we do know. That's why we have to quit saying that. We do know what it is. It is cotton in the sample. The sample is cotton.
It does not matter. We should study it. I can't know now if it is a neutron radiation, a cotton or other thing, but it is important to know to date this piece.
Julia, that's what we're saying. If we want to look at that piece in terms of dating, then you need to send it to Bob, and it needs to be characterized as a linen sample, first of all. We don't even know that that's linen. That also might be cotton. And it needs to be
This sample is at our disposition, I think, for Fondazione Traemme.
I would suggest that if we're going to do something worthwhile, we come up with an action plan that makes sense in terms of an actual analysis of samples that we really have available, or if we don't have samples available, we come up with an action plan.
A moment. From this sample, I have taken a few threads and fibers that were analyzed, and I have presented the preliminary result at the Shroud Science level, so also you have the result. These results are very well compatible with the results obtained from the whole part of the shroud, because I have taken many fibers from different areas, and I've compared with chemical analysis, Raman, FTR, and so on, and fingerprint results the same. So there is no reason to think that this sample is not part of the main shroud. In any case, the main purpose is to date this sample and to show that there is a continuous variation in the date. If I don't think to obtain the first century as a result, but if I took the 80th century, 90th century, it would be a very good result, because it should confirm this contamination due to some factor to be detected, but it should be the basis for a future analysis to be performed by Charles.
Might I ask? I'm going to ask you a question. It seems to me that we have a rare opportunity to access some technology that none of the rest of us could ever access. You have access to reserve a sample, and we have a gentleman from Los Alamos.
No, from reserve a sample. The reserve is this one, and I have the border of the reserve. The reserve is in Turin. This piece, very little, is at the Fondazione Traemme.
Okay, that's the 3M piece.
Yes.
Well, but so you're confident that it's actual linen?
I have studied it, it resulted linen.
Okay. My suggestion is, since there are things like XPS, and Joe, or Sue, can you give Bob this? We have an opportunity for additional testing.
Yes. Okay.
We hook you up with Bob.
Yes.
Maybe you get the samples to Bob.
Yes.
Let's get some additional data, and we don't have to argue the point.
Yes, sir.
Because
yes,
the data is what's not arguable.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Makes sense?
And I want to say, look, in order to really accomplish something, we have to work together.
Yes.
And in order to work together, we've got to support each other in those areas where we have limitations. Like I stated in my talk this morning, we had limitations in that we had three threads. And all three threads, according to what was given to me, came from the one sample area. I have to assume that that is correct, on the word of Barry and Sue.
And Ray Rogers.
And Ray Rogers. Now, the other limitation we had was that we did not have an actual thread from the actual shroud so that we could use that as a standard. If we could only get one thread from the actual shroud, then we could qualify. We could qualify this, and then we could speak with a lot more confidence in what we need to do in the future. But we have to recognize what our strengths are and what our weaknesses are, what our limitations are. And at the present time, we have access to some of the best equipment in the world. But that is only as strong as being able to get standards. And that's why we need to see if there is somebody that can help us so that we can have a standard that we can really put our head on.
The problem is this, we are speaking of threads or fibers, because I have many fibers, but very, very few threads, and how much longer?
It doesn't matter to us, because we have the sensitivity
have
and the resolution
one fiber.
To analyze
fibers,
a single fiber.
I have fiber in my room. If you want, I can give you one.
I'd like to quickly interject something. This is a reminder of what caused the STRF team to be the success that it was. It was a group of multidisciplinary scientists working in unison as a team with a singular purpose that went together, worked as a team, operated as a team, came back and operated as a team until the camera started to roll. But the point simply is this. The idea of cooperation, this is not a competition. If we're competing against anybody, it's the people who control the shroud and won't allow any access to it. So that means we have to work, as Bob said, with what we have. And I know that this is editorializing, but what the heck, I'm already up here. And I just think that there's a necessity to work as a team, even if you're in Italy and we're here. And we have an opportunity to access technology that no other opportunity like this would exist. So, if you have samples, get together with Bob. Let's proceed.
Tomorrow morning. Let me see. Finish.
There's a question. Okay. No.
Awesome.
There it is.
You say qualified.
This is. This is.
Under control to determine that it's absolutely linen and nothing else. Or what do you mean by qualification?
If we could get a qualified sample that is aged linen, and having a fiber from the main shroud that we could look at, now we can look at the scan on that fiber. We know what linen looks like, but it's not aged like it is in the main shroud. So we need that. And if he could provide it, fine, let's do it. And we'll get together, we will work that, and
then you're working with Los Alamos.
yes.
Not a bad piece.
Also with Rogers, of course.
I can get you some aged linen, but I don't have access to shroud fibers. Do you need aged linen?
I would prefer to have a shroud fiber.
Yeah, I can't get you that. So
yeah. But Julia, you can give it to me if you have. This way, not me, not you. You do that.
The question is the C-14 issue.
I think he needs some old linen that isn't the shroud.
As well. You have Cinder. If he has all this, then you were the one that wanted to know. But not me, not with Cinder. This is why I told you, remember, I told you later, I want you to work with him.
And
the linen I have is probably closer, by Ray's judgment, closer to about 1300 BC.
This is fun.
I can't say the age is never been regularly.
We need to work together. This is important. What's important
is that that it's not going to be 100 years old.
This was on a mummy foot.
We just need to get something.
I'm very honest. If I think something, I tell you. You're not from Torrey. I'm not from Torrey.
This may be contaminated with
natron.
Like
linen fibers of different ages, so that you can get
that profile. That would help. Okay, anything that I can get to give us more
confidence? Oh, three. It's a phone that's the owner.
Julio, a question.
Excuse me, can I finish?
Answer the question, Julia. I'm the moderator.
I finish the question with him. Tomorrow morning, I will give you a fiber coming from the shroud, but it came from the ridgy dust, aspirate dust, that I've selected and I recognized as Turin shroud fiber. It is not certificated from Turin, but I can certificate only.
Well, that's okay, because whatever you can do, I want to shake.
He's trying to shake the hand.
Let's do it.
All right. Can you imagine, folks, you're attending a conference where something might actually get done?
Julio, the question that I have, if you have a sample, I don't know how many threads you have still from the reserve, so-called reserva, but if you can get to Bob samples from that so he can qualify it as linen and match it with
the
sample, then we know before we send it to C14 sampling, it's not cotton. Do you see what I'm saying? So that is the key point here. If we're going to do C14, we need to characterize whatever we're going to do. That is with the exception of if we ever get a hold of any dust, and that's a whole different issue. But if we can get actual fibers, if it has access to that, let's characterize it.
This is from the
determination.
This is from
the determination. We are dealing with aged linen.
No. From here also.
How much he has.
Yes.
Do we really know that the whole medieval patch would be cotton? One of my concerns is that the patch might not be entirely cotton. And so even if you have linen fibers, maybe if there is a patch, maybe there's linen in the patch.
Let me clarify.
You're exactly right, Ray. Bob and his team, and of course that was my hypothesis, and of course if you look at the books that we showed you from Paul, you look at the splicing technique that we showed you, there has got to be an intermingling of the old and new. However, in the sample, the samples that we have so far, one of the three, we'll be hopefully getting Bob more of the right sample. In the fibers, they looked at individual fibers over the 27. In each breath, we could find no linen. There's no linen.
I could use slide from before, but let me just remind you that Ryan Walsh showed that there was a gradient to the area, in which, thankfully, very well documented. We don't know why that gradient's there, and certainly it can be from a patch of green weed. I think we all agree to that. But if you notice someone else, in many slides here, we've talked about the thermal problem or the potential for contaminating by the pyrolysis activated gases that diffuse through the cloth. Let me say that again. If you look closely at each burn, you will see a gradient right in the area of the burn. This is going from non-material to virgin material. And you've got to put two and two together. When the molten metal contacted the linen, it didn't burn, as in the silent witness. It pyrolyzed. It vaporized and sent a cloud of very active free radicals out to be absorbed by the linen. No, well, I'm saying this is entertainment, remember, this is just entertainment. Don't take it seriously. But I talked with Al Adler about this, and he agreed that when you take the ratio of 14 to 7, you get a 15% difference, which is a large difference from a molecular atomic basis. And if you notice some of the photographs of the burn area, you'll see little shadows running from the hot spot of the fire. Now let's just try to fold it. This is the most interesting part. Folding this, you'll see.
This is interesting?
Okay. Like this way. All right. Now, I can't see which way to go here, but that's
okay.
All right, go this way.
You don't want me to tell you where to go.
Now, I think you can see what I'm leading up to. When you fold this, you will see that as the burn areas stack, what happens is the edge of the cloth, I'll do this quickly, the edge turns out to be only about that far from ground zero of the pyrolysis. And if you notice how much, there's a lot of material, there's a lot of material missing. Where did those vapors go? And I would say that if you've ever done any chromatography, or if you've ever done any kinetics of gases, you know that in the ionized form, the outside of the molecule looks the same, but the inside of the molecule weighed 14 versus 12, under the same thermal conditions, the heavier molecules are going to coalesce first. This is a fact of chromatography, diffusion of gases, anything else. Atomic bomb was made this way, by the diffusion process.
That's how they purified the uranium.
What's that?
That's how they purified the uranium.
Right, right. It's a very serious operation. But the main point is this. There's a very simple experiment with Paul Maloney, and I talked about when we didn't have any money. But you can take any linen, and this, I'm just suggesting this is a kind of a homework assignment that could be done without turin. We don't even need turin. We don't need to argue, Lolita. What can be done is you take a sample of any linen, placing it in a Pyrex tube, dipping one end into the molten metal, and drawing gently on the sample. This will produce a gradient on the linen, and it will make a very different concentration of 14C14, 14, 14, 12. And the reason I say this is because I worked for Hercules for a number of years, and we make carbon fiber. Carbon fiber is made from regular fiber. It starts out with regular Orlon fiber, and in the process, we literally subjected to a fire, and then we pull it through an electric furnace, and the vapors in the furnace are foaming back on the fiber.
When you can turn into cotton and come to
me.
No, we're not talking about that issue. We're not talking about. What we're saying is it possible that the thermal gradient had an influence on the gradient that Brian Walsh and others have seen? Now, I'll step back and say again, Paul and I talked about this, and as you remember, we talked to Austin Long, and he said this was a very unique experiment that had never been done. John Jackson did the carbon dioxide, which proved not to be
irrelevant.
Well, that's a good point. Is it or is it not? Have you done the experiment?
I haven't done the experiment, but it doesn't matter.
Are you sure of that?
Well, you do the experiment and publish it in peer review. There's been a lot of research on radiocarbon. You're talking about a cotton corner. Turn it into cotton, and then you'll have my attention.
I can't hear. Right. You've got to pass that microphone around.
Oh, I'm saying the same thing.
Well, okay, Ray.
I'd just like to weigh in on this a little bit because I think there's more than one possibility. I'm sympathetic to the patch theory. The main part of the reason I'm sympathetic to the patch theory is Brian Walsh's gradient. Marcel, I think it is, on the Shroud Science Group, seems to be arguing that the gradient could be an artifact of just the fact that the different labs had different accuracies, and there's a one chance in three. When you take three samples, you're going to almost always get differences. And the probability that they'll be in an increasing order in one direction or the other is one chance in three. So you got a one chance in three probability that Brian's gradient is purely random, and that, in fact, the data is fine. Now, the one thing that's really going for Sue is the cotton.
Well,
I mean, let's face it, the cotton shouldn't be there.
And not just the cotton.
And the presence.
All the other factors, too.
But what?
All the other factors, too. I mean, all the other stuff that Ray found. I mean,
hold on a second, because we can't hear you, Sue. So
yeah,
we need to, if we're going to have this kind of thing, then we need to get the microphone back and forth.
Everybody needs a microphone.
Yeah, everyone needs a microphone.
Everybody bring a microphone.
I'm just saying that this is, we're being.
I don't need a microphone.
Yeah.
Ray doesn't need.
That's what my mother used to say, too.
My point is, it's not just the cotton. It's everything. It's every other factor, every other variable that Ray found, that everyone else has found, that we have reported. If you paid attention, our paper is out now in Chemistry Today. It's a peer-reviewed journal article. What you saw today presented, I would offer it up to anybody. Publish something, refute this, come up with a technique that turns linen into cotton, and then come talk to me. If you haven't done that, then your hypothesis does not fit. If you cannot explain all the data points, if you are concerned and don't know what they are, then educate yourself. It's not a matter of throwing a little bit of heat, a little bit of neutrons here and there. You have a lot of variables to account for.
I don't think anybody's attacking that point.
I'm just saying, let's move on from there. Let's quit debating the issue. We know what it is, and let's move on to something fruitful. If Julio has a sample fit for dating, fit for analysis, then by all means, let's work on an action plan. We're doing too much of the circular, it could be this, it could be that. Let's go beyond that. Let's go beyond, okay, what can we do? I mean, is there thymol in that? Once he verifies, let's say you have a sample that is big enough to at least...
I have fibers. Fondazione 3M is the sample.
The 3M, okay, well, let's say we have access. Let's just pretend as a starting point that we have potential access to something that can be characterized as aged linen and not cotton, not having the matter root, the gum, all the other variables that we know, and let's say that we can put together an action plan to do that, then we need to look at legitimate things. Like, what about the thymol? How do we get that off? As Bob had said, they could probably help with that. It's, getting it off the linen, is, as I understood Barry to say, is not as big of an issue as Ray once thought. Maybe that's an action plan to work on that. Let's talk about stuff that is fruitful. Instead of continuously regurgitating and reiterating things that are absolutely irrelevant at this point.
Okay, good. That's a perfect opportunity for me to be the moderator and say, let's could let Larry, who's standing here, who wants to make a comment, let him make a comment. Thank you very much.
Just a caution and maybe an alternative. In 78, the team did some wonderful work.
There.
By 1987, the case was virtually made on the credibility of the Shroud. And then in the 88 carbon dating, for better or for worse, for right or wrong, the credibility was destroyed. It's, you got the credibility of the Shroud is on the ropes. And everything I've heard here today, this session, says the sample is everything. Whichever sample you use, the caution is you're going to live or die, the Shroud will live or die, the credibility of the Shroud will live or die on that sample. So if there's any doubt, don't do it, or do it quietly and confidentially. And there are some other possibilities that didn't exist 20 years ago. As I understand, the scrapings, the carbon scrapings, are available and plentiful.
They're not available.
Not available. Not available, but this says somebody.
Not available to anyone.
To anyone right now because of Turin.
Because Turin holds them, controls them, and is not making them available.
I would say this, though. If we need a reliable sample, and that would be a better reliable sample, if one thread is needed from the center of the Shroud, and that would be a better, this is the last chance. So whatever sample we go with, better be the right sample this time. There's no third chance. And you know, I think it would be difficult for the authorities, and I realize it's a tough sell. It's going to be difficult for them to say no to one thread or to a few scrapings when we wouldn't even be asking for all of them. It's not destructive, not asking for much, but I'm just saying, whatever we go with, well, before it gets public, it better be the right sample.
Well, one of the concerns I have about the fact that Oxford is revisiting the issue with the John Jackson theory is if John Jackson's theory of carbon monoxide fails, Oxford's going to say, well, we did our best, and that's it, the Shroud's fake. So I'm actually very concerned about what's happening with the Jackson theory. And so a gentleman from a NASA scientist who is I correspond with from the website put together a letter that he's sending. And what he did in this letter was he went down through all of the scientific data that's come down in the last 20 years, and he listed every scientific, credible scientific piece of data in the literature and in other places that indicates an anomaly in the sample. And that includes, number one on the list, the radiocarbon dating paper of 1988, which in that paper did indicate cotton was found, et cetera, et cetera. My only concern is that the door doesn't slam closed if they find that carbon monoxide isn't the answer. So this scientist is sending this information off to the people involved in England. And I advised him to hold off and not send that letter yet because I said this conference is happening and there's going to be some new data. So my hope is that this long list, and when he sent me the list, I was overwhelmed at how much credible data there is that says.
One other point I want to make before you go to the mic, and that is on this sample here, I know nothing about it except that if it's true and I'm on the other side, I'm going to be arguing chain of custody. Where has that sample been in the last 20 years?
There is a good chain of custody on that sample that Julian's talking about. That has.
But it wouldn't be as good a chain of custody as having one thread taken from the Shroud today.
Yeah, that isn't going to happen.
I'm just saying that may be possible.
Yeah, but and I can attest to the fact that Julio's access to the 3M sample, which is the Regi material, that has been well documented. That is credible material. So that's the reason for we're trying to get him connected with Bod and let them do some testing.
Yeah, I have been in touch with Ramsey at Oxford. We've had many communications. They've been talking also to Beta Analytic, and it's no secret that I've been working with Beta Analytic. Oxford's very interested if we can get an approved sample. You've had contact, yeah, that they would do the sample for us. So they do not believe carbon monoxide is going to amount to anything, and once again, I would challenge Jackson to show how it turns into cotton with carbon monoxide also. So, once again, unless you can answer that, then you know.
reminder.
There are several comments. Number one, I believe that the area was rewoven. Matter of fact, those of you at the 89 meeting, I showed slides that was indicating that there's rewoven material in the carbon 14 sample. We had analyzed the videos of them taking the sample. There were obviously abnormal threads, standing on edge, running through the sample area.
And a different color, too, Alan.
Pardon?
And a different color, because you sent me some video footage, and it was real obvious, a different color.
Right. That was not well received by many at the particular meeting, however. So that we believe that. I am concerned about just doing another carbon dating on the shroud, because two other important relics have been carbon dated also. The Severum of Oviedo is carbon dated, supposedly, the 7th century. The tunic of Argentoya was also carbon dated, reportedly to the 7th century. We feel that there's no doubt that the Severum is authentic. That's the face cloth. We think it's highly likely that the tunic of Argentoya is the seamless robe that's been in Paris since 800. And there are a number of bloodstains on it. That's not been well studied, but the number of bloodstains on that would seem to match those on the shroud. So we think that that's likely old. But the fact that those have elevated dates would indicate to me that there may be two factors here affecting the carbon dating. Number one is the fact that they took a rewoven area for the dating, but there may be another factor, which may be, we suspect, neutron radiation, which will also add to this effect, in which case, the correct dating with this shroud sample may come out to be slightly elevated. As an MAKM called in 7th century too, and we have to be prepared for that. We ought to know ahead of time what neutrons are going to do to the carbon dating. So that we feel that's important. I might make another comment which may interest Bob. That's that Max Frey got very interested in various things, and so he took samples from some of the other relics too. Including the crown of thorns and the tunic of Argentoya. There are the threads from the tunic which are potentially available for study. So they're at least back to 800. We think very likely they go back to the first century. But anyway, that's we could supply a small piece of that for analysis. So you'll have an old piece of linen, which very possibly could be the same age as the shroud, but we don't know. I think it's most important to test the shroud, but we think that there is a piece which we could supply to you.
If you could supply that, I will. Like I said before, we're all in this together, and we have to cooperate with one another. If somebody here has access to a thread or a piece of whatever cloth and has some idea as to what the age is, that's going to help us. The more of this that we get, the more confidence we have in what we're working on. And so, yes, if you've got that. I would like to comment about the neutron, being from Los Alamos. I built a lot of neutron sources, and I irradiated a lot of things. And this is one thing that Ray Rogers said. I studied this by bombarding it with this, with that, with that. And now I want to bombard it with alpha particles. But we do a lot of irradiations with neutrons. And all we have to do is know what the cross-section is of that cloth, and we can tell you how many atoms you're going to, with the flux that you've got. The fluxes you've got have to be in the neighborhood of 10 to the 10th neutrons per square centimeter per second. If it's less than that, it's not going to do anything. Believe me. And I can make the calculation.
Just a second,
to the microphone.
What's the neutron flux in terms of its energy? If you don't know, and where's the neutron hypothesis coming from? This is fairly easy to calculate. If you know the cross-section of what you're dealing with, and you know your neutron flux spectrum, you can come up with how many captures you're going to get. From that, you can derive what the contamination level might be. And so until somebody has some quantitative numbers, why are we worried about it?
Hey, amen.
And so that's what I say. Right now, I think what we have to be concerned about is getting more confidence in the standards, the references that we've got, and this can help. But anybody who has a sample that can help us. Yet, what I think is also something we need to discuss is, in today's world, how large a sample do we need for carbon dating? I don't know. I think Sue has looked into that, and maybe
5 milligrams.
5 milligrams.
Or we can do micrograms, depending on the age range that you want.
Yes, but that's the 10 millimeters of the fiber that we had was 0.2 milligrams. So
that was too small.
So we need to at least, if we're going to make a credible argument for redoing the carbon 14 dating, we need to know what size of sample is required to get a good statistical analysis.
To make a point while I'm thinking of it, most people's email addresses are in the program if they presented. Bob was not, because we have a special insert. If you have a cloth or something that you'd like to get to them, please make a point of exchanging email addresses with them before the conference is over.
I wanted to finish the comment I was starting. Whether or not the area is due to reweaving per se, there's no question that that area is anomalous. I'm not convinced we know why it's anomalous, other than the fact we know there's intrusives in the form of cotton, whether that's due to invisible weaving or some other mechanism. But there may be other mechanisms that cause the problem. And if we stay in that area that we know was contaminated, it's not clear that another dating in that area isn't likely to also be contaminated. Maybe not as much, maybe differently. We should ensure that the sample we date is linen. We should ensure probably that the cleaning is aggressive. But I'll go back with Bill Meacham's comments. We need multiple sites ultimately to make sure we control for the possibility of non-uniform contamination means that would contaminate different parts of the shroud in different degrees. If we had like 3 samples from widely separated sites and they all came out medieval, well, we'd pack up our bags and go home. But if we have 3 widely separated sites, the probability that they're all contaminated by the same process is fairly unlikely. And we've got, as the worst case would be, hey, we'll get a really big difference in dates and we'll know that the shroud is probably as old as the old state.
I'm going to interject now as the moderator. I would like Joe, who just said something to me personally, I think he needs to say it to everybody.
I was going to suggest that any of these conjectures that have to do with, for example, neutron capture of the sample from a neutron source or diffusion of other contaminants, any of these conjectures be documented. It's very simple. It's very straightforward to write a little white paper, 1 page or 2. Let's press on. My point. We know we're going to press on. If anybody has any serious objections that can be quantified, then I suggest you just send these white papers to some point of contact, whoever.
Me, and I'll pass them to Bob any place.
And let's get on with it. If there's a serious objection that we should look at, then document it, and we'll take a look at it, or whoever's going to be the sifter here, take a look at the objection, and if there is something that's worth looking at, we'll look at it.
I like that we, Joe.
No.
Yeah. I heard you say we.
I was just looking at the tongue.
Uh-huh. Let's date it all. How about the tablecloth that Sue's sitting at, okay? Okay, let's try and get a new point of view. Thank you. There you go.
I think the Oviedo
cloth and the shrouded turret are historically the same age. I think that's reasonable. However, if we're talking about neutrons and some paranormal event is adjusting the shroud, the Oviedo cloth was not on the body at the time Jesus was buried.
Correct.
And so it might be interesting to see as if they're comparatively different age due to whatever reasons.
Okay. Point. Okay, someone else? We need to give everybody a chance and an opportunity. And Chris Navenchu in the back.
Just kind of a comment slash question, I guess, for especially the STIRP members. I know that carbon dating was kind of the big blow to the shrouded world, so to speak, but in some way, did it have kind of a positive influence in that? You know, did it keep kind of the momentum of the study, the research, the scientific testing alive? And if that carbon dating would have been, you know, say, okay, yep, 33 AD or something like that, would that have been kind of the end, and would something like this weekend not have happened?
Now, actually, what happened, Chris, is it brought everything in the world of shroud research to a screeching halt for about 8 to 10 years. I mean, most of us were just sort of sitting around stunned going, what about the Prey manuscript? And so some of us who knew about the Prey manuscript immediately had some kind of, I'm not talking just about myself, I'm talking about most of the people in the Shroud world that were serious students of the Shroud knew right off the bat that, well, how do you account for, if you say 1260 to 13 whatever, what about this thing 70 years earlier, 80 years earlier, that is pretty much indisputably the Shroud of Turin that was illustrated. So it did not have a positive effect. Now, after things started picking up again and people started projecting theories about what might have gone wrong with the carbon dating, that sort of began to draw people back out again. So it was a dip in Shroud research for, I'm guessing, 8 to 10 years, and then it sort of picked up again. So
I guess kind of a follow-up question then. If they end up eventually sometime down the road actually recarbonating it, we get a more accurate data of what most people at least assume it to be, would you or anyone here assume that still that further testing and research will still definitely be done because of what else might be involved in the shroud, or we keep on going just because we're so adamant about disproving the carbonating?
Well, I think if it's properly dated and in the future sometime, and certainly if it gets a date that would make you happy, Chris, that would pretty much put an end to it for you. You'd be happy with that, and you'd move right on. Look, it's the Shroud of Turin. It's the most controversial object on the planet, or maybe somebody can think of one more controversial. And I just think what happens is people believe what they want to believe, and the truth and the facts and the science don't even matter to a lot of people. So, you know, we're always going to fight that. If you're going to be involved with the Shroud of Turin, get your skin to be a lot thicker, or go do something else. So, I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but that's sort of a thing.
If it dates to 33, all the skeptics will yell fraud.
Of course.
I mean, that's what's going
to
happen.
Well, I was giving a lecture, and a skeptic said to me, I think it was on a radio show, the guy said to me, you know, the Shroud of Turin's too perfect, it can't be real. So I said, so if it were less perfect, then you would accept its authenticity? He said, of course not. That's the problem. Alan.
That is it. One reason my wife and I pursued the carbon dating is because we had previously dated the shroud by several other means to the spring of 30 AD in Israel. So we didn't believe the carbon dating for a moment. So that's why we went to find out what was wrong and got the videos of taking the sample and saw that it was obviously rewoven. So that I think that, you know, that we have no doubt that about the date. It's doubly self-dated by these coins over the eyes and their dark work based on the shroud dated 31 AD. So that leaves very little elbow room. I think we kind of suffer from our problem in that if we can't disprove the carbon dating, it must be medieval. I think we need to take a more positive outlook that it's ancient and
There's about 1,000 other pieces of evidence that indicate that it is ancient. So, you know, one test and the whole world throws it away. Okay. Welcome to the 21st century. Julia wanted to say something.
Okay, fine.
I'm sorry, Alan. I thought you were.
This was the sample. single thread that he took that we think, you know, came from the one end of it was in the area where the carbon dating was taken from. The other end was out in the shroud. The end, which he said there's something abnormal, I thought starch or something of the sort. That's why I cut it in half and carbon dated the two ends. The end with the contamination was 1000 AD. The other end was 200 AD. So that I think that you know, we already have pretty good indications that that the shroud is, you know, trouble. Test out that better.
Something so anomalous there. Something is anomalous there.
This radiometric dating is an hourglass that got turned over with sand in the top, sand in the bottom. And if you don't know how much sand was in the top to start with, you won't know. There is no reliable radiometric dating method. What, does anybody know what time it is right now? Look at your watch.
9:13.
How do you know that?
I'm looking at the digital clock.
And how do you know that's true?
Oh, this one's connected to the Colorado clock.
Right. And so it's been connected to a known standard.
Correct.
We don't have any known standards for linen in the first century.
It's true.
So all you need is a known standard, and then even then, the contamination is a problem.
Which is exactly what Bob is talking about, why he's trying to get his hands on one.
So I think it's worth doing, but to hang your hat on the one hook that's left without a hat on it, and the whole rest of the room is full of hats and coats of all the evidence that proves the shroud is true. I agree with Alan. The preponderance of the evidence is what we base science on. Not the one thing we couldn't understand. I'm an ER doctor. I got one thing I don't understand about the patient. I don't stop giving them antibiotic.
Thanks, Doc. I'm glad to know that. I'm sure my insurance company is happy to hear that, too.
I hear what you're saying. I very much would like to agree with you. You only have one problem with that. The bell has already been rung. You can't unring it. And that thing is going to hang out there until something is done. It's going to hang out there. I'm not saying we have the solution.
That's my point. If you have to be doing it for dating, tap the clock. Whose clock?
No, you know, everybody's making valid points, but the frustration, you know, let's face it, the real issue here is the fact that access to the shroud is impossible, and we're struggling because we don't have very much material to work with. I mean, that's about as obvious as you can get. Julio.
What I wanted to say is another thing. Data exchange is on the basis of scientific progress. We have found in 2002 a shroud science group with the aim to exchange data. Most of us are of shroud science group, but many others are not. I take the occasion to invite all in this conference, all the present in this conference, to be part of shroud science group in order to discuss together all of these problems. If you want, you can give me your email address, and I invite you as soon as possible.
Larry wants to make a point?
You may be right. Maybe there's no access, but I think perhaps there is, because today's technology requires a smaller sample. It doesn't have to be as destructive. And so we might go after that sample, and while we're doing that, quietly and confidentially, take half this sample and look at it. And then if we can't get access elsewhere, and we see the result on half the sample that's been kept confidential, then make your decision, you know, about what to do with the other half of that sample.
That's a reasonable thing.
You know, never ask a question to really answer to. And I mean, we get this wrong, everything that's happened to date's meaningless because the credibility, nobody even talk about it anymore. So we've got to make sure that this is, it's a live or die to do this. So I suggest that we try for access on the smallest piece of the actual shroud, maybe it's three small pieces, and we give that 60 days or whatever. Meanwhile, this sample can be done privately. And I mean, like two or three people, kept totally confidential on half that sample, and then you've got the other half to work with. If it, you know,
it's a viable possibility. But you're right. I think if there's one more go around and the the public, if it comes out publicly that, you know, that it's failed, whatever the next test is publicly, then the people who think we're crazy will now all then, you know, that'll, I mean, they won't even want to regard us as anything, you know. Any, is there anybody else out there that hasn't spoken? It would be great to hear from somebody who's, young lady in the back. Do please stand up.
I like that young part.
It's okay. I've learned diplomacy being involved with this, right?
I just wanted to say that I don't think you have that much to worry about. I really think that this is such a compelling piece of cloth that C-14 is going to come and go. Historically, this is... outweighs anything like that, and that knowing science, which I do not know, I expect something far greater than C-14 is going to surpass it any day now. In fact, some of the researchers that are here may be the ones that discover that it's inadequate, there's a better way to date this clock. I really think that what we're looking at is a gift that we're supposed to keep studying and learning from. And it's teaching us a lot. It's not just teaching us about the man whose body we can see on that cloth, but also about each other. And as this gentleman said, working together, I really think that should be the concentration now. And we shouldn't get too shook about the carbon dating. I heard about it. This is the first conference I've been to. I don't know any of you people. I drove here from Philadelphia because I like the website and I thought I'd like to know more. And I'm not a scientist, but I really think that people who want to know about the trap will find out about the trap. When I heard about the carbon dating, 10 years ago or whatever, I thought, 20 years ago, I'm that young. I just thought, oh gee, yeah, it's a hoax. But I'm an art historian and they start to talk about Leonardo da Vinci as usual, and you just begin to go, something's wrong here. And I just think we need to get apart and calm down. Now look at what comes next. Forget this fact that there's a patch and it's cotton. Yes, I mean, I could have told you that just looking at it, not that it was cotton, but there was something wrong with that poor cloth, young nobody. So what do we concentrate on now? And what is beyond that
form? Well, I appreciate your optimism. I think the thing that I have to explain about the people, if you were to take the accumulated involvement of time of the people in this room, it would probably reach about 500 years or something of invested time and energy. And so I think that there's, you know, it's a subject about which most people are very passionate. But from a purely empirical scientific point of view, which is where we're trying to be, we're doing the best we can, and both hands are tied behind our back because we don't have access to samples, etc. So, you know, thank you for the positive sort of enlightenment kind of feeling, but understand the passion of the people in this room comes from the fact that some of us have been involved for 30 or more years, and there's a lot of frustration, too. So, it's a reflection of all of the above, but thank you. Russell had something.
But I liked what you just said. It could be the name of our next conference, Moving Beyond the Corner.
Yeah, there you go. I like that. That's good. That's certainly better than hanging around the corner, which is what I've often been accused of doing. Someone else. T.D. Omer.
I have been a research scientist for many years. I know how many ways things can go wrong. I want to play the cautious role. I agree with some of the positions here that say that I know even radio carbon dating, if you do it from the real area, it can still go wrong for whatever reasons you don't know.
That's right.
So I would take the more cautious, and we don't want more negative publicity, so we might want to do our own private investigation. And if we find that it comes out all right, then you can submit the sample to the public.
I think Larry said yesterday that it's better not to do it than to get it wrong one more time.
That's
Didn't you say that, Larry?
Yeah.
Okay, good. See, I'm quoting you. So, gentleman in the back who hasn't spoken yet. Good.
Thank you for calling me a gentleman. I think it's important to recognize that the state of the art today on carbon dating of lead, there is a large database out there. Okay. Databases where the mummies and the linen that they were wrapped in have been dated.
Yeah, but this we're
the Habsburgs and their linen that they were wrapped in have been dated. In all cases, the carbon dating is hundreds to more than 1,000 years younger than the bones of the body of the mummies or of the birds and this sort of thing.
Right.
There is a great uncertainty in carbon dating of linen.
Correct.
And that uncertainty means that anything that you're going to be dating in ancient linen is going to come out considerably younger than it really is. Pushing for carbon dating, even the carbon that has been collected from the restoration, is going to give you, if it follows anything of what's been seen in the past, a much younger date than what you expect from all this other information that you have.
Well,
that shows
the ibis mummies that you were talking about, wasn't that Rosalie David at Manchester Museum?
It was 600 years difference.
Was that her name? Rex, the woman from the Manchester Museum?
Yes, in Manchester.
What was her name?
The Manchester mummy was 1,000 years. The
right.
Ebbersburg was 600.
Was the woman who runs that museum? Rosalie David, that's what I thought. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that was done, and the reason that they were using the ibis mummies as an example is because they were, you know, like when we go to a grave and we leave flowers, apparently the Egyptians would go and leave mummies, little mummies, and the concern was, had somebody manipulated by taking the body out and rewrapping it in newer linens, well, nobody would do that with something that would have been thrown away, and I think the Manchester Museum has thousands, if not tens of thousands of these. So that was an indicator that there was an issue with radiocarbon dating. Well, somebody once said, "Be careful what you wish for." So I think that's the point you're making.
Those comments require some documentation, and if it really is true, I doubt that you could expect something like that across the board. You know,
Hold on, Joe. Just start from the beginning, and so we can hear you.
I think that's one of those other comments that requires some documentation or investigation. I mean, if it's really true that linen is routinely dated wrong, then I think we're wasting our time here. But I don't believe that's the case. There may be some isolated incidents where, for some pathological reason, a bunch of mummies come up, you know, 1,000 years. I mean, because that doesn't make any sense intrinsically. By the way, I want to say that radiocarbon dating, it happens to be, like it or not, the worldwide standard dating things. And it's done routinely. The archaeologists pull things out of fire pits that are in unbelievable condition to come up with ages that are reasonably consistent with, you know, the other circumstances. So, I mean, if we can't rely on it, at least at some level, of, you know, getting the right answer, then we're sort of wasting our time here. In fact, we might be shooting ourselves in the foot. I think that my feeling is, and maybe it's the feeling of other people, that we ought to press on with it. It's a worldwide accepted standard. Let's do it the best we can. If there's some documentation that would provide us, that could be provided to the team that says, you know, there's a good chance this date's going to come out wrong for these less and so documented reasons, then maybe we ought to consider that. But otherwise, let's press on.
I agree. Can I ask a question? Is there someone who knows whether the information from Rosalie David at the Manchester Museum was ever published in any kind of a journal? Or where does that, is that anecdotal? Where did that come from? Dan, hold on, talk in the microphone.
All I know about it is she has published in connection with Harry Gold and Steve Mattingly of the University of Texas and Leon Steele Garza Valdez. And I
okay.
Sorry, some of those names don't ring my bell very loud.
Well, anyway, I can get that information. And her reputation, I think, is the most
she is the
true to life in terms of the field of carbon.
Yeah, she's a very respected PhD.
I'll get that.
Dr. Rosalie Day. But I've heard that information. God, that got to go back at least 20 years, perhaps even before the carbon dating.
I think their idea was that there's some bacterial buildup on the outer surface, on the outer.
Oh, that's why Mattingly was involved in
it. That are bacteria that are aerobic, and that they wouldn't have lived, they wouldn't have thrived in the connection with the body itself.
But on the
a certain age, and can be dated. But that the outer limit to the outer wrappings would be contaminated by more and more live and acting organic matter.
Okay. Okay. Thanks for amplifying. Okay, over to Ray Schneider.
On the ibis,
I read about the ibis and what is it, Garcia Bell, whatever.
Yeah, that was not the primary source of that information.
I understand, but he there was a comment somewhere along the line. I did a little research on that, and the speculation was that the reason that the ibis dates older than the linnet is that it's a fishy bird, and that the fish, if the fish it's eating don't feed on plants that are living near, then they don't acquire contemporary carbon. And the result is that the ibis tends to systematically date older than it really is. So that, it wasn't that the linnet dated young, it was that the ibis dated old. But I don't know whether there's been any controls or any statistical demonstrations that ibises routinely date old.
I don't want to take any credit for the knowledge about carbon dating. Only that the operative mummy was human feeding. Meaning,
there's more than one, because the ibis is also another case.
Yeah, but I mean, the one that defines this issue was a human being, a menial, as they found, that would not have liked to have been re-wrapped. Because it was a newer wrapping. So, and the difference was 1,400 or some thousand years.
Somebody should do a statistical analysis on that, because we do have two, given that the tunic dates young.
As Al pointed out, the tunic dates young, the Oviedo cloth dates young, the shroud dates young for probably different reasons. There's an awful lot of young dating stuff, and maybe before we... I haven't seen any studies whatsoever on statistically examining the anomalies in dating linnet. But we know a whole bunch of things that appear to be anomalies to us. Somebody should do that study before
Meacham,
we go out and hang our hat.
Meacham's 86 paper detailed the problems that he had in dating some of the Chinese linnet. So, he went into some detail, but I don't know whether it was statistical analysis. It's on the website. You can check it out.
Okay. The Institute for Creation Research has a book out called Radioactivity and the Age of the Earth. There's another radioelectromagnetograph by Harold Schlosser called Radioactivity and the Degradation of the Earth's Magnetic Field, The Origin and Destiny of the Earth's Magnetic Field, which distinctly affects carbon dating. Because if you degrade the Earth's magnetic field, more cosmic radiation can come in directly than at the poles, because it's not being deflected, and so it's not a steady state. In the rate book, I've actually read the whole rate book, okay? And it's worth getting, Radioactivity and the Age of the Earth by the Institute for Creation Research. John Rungardner, Russ Humphreys.
Doctor, point?
Now, well, the point is that standard temperature and pressure change radioactive decay. We know that now. We didn't know that before the rate book. Books, it's not a standard clock. You don't know how big the orifice is in the hourglass. It can change with temperature and pressure. It can change with singularities like the resurrection. It can change with the fire 1532. It can change with smoking. and other things. We change with pressure. So if we know that the rocks that were erupted by Mount St. Helens have been dated in millions of years and we watched them form, excuse me, but you know, potassium argon and uranium lead studies don't bear out at all. Completely worthless.
Can I ask, is this in some literature other than a commercial book?
It's a published scientific study by the Great Commission.
I don't know who that is.
Just look, get it from the Institute for Creation Research. You could probably get it from Answers in Genesis.
The Institute for what?
The Institution for Creation Research was founded by Henry Morris in the 1960s and 70s. And it is all PhD scientists, all in their element. Most people here probably know who Russ Humphreys and John Bumgard are. Russ Humphreys invented the Rimfire Trigger.
Just take a show of hands quickly. Anybody heard of him?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Well, I'm just asking because okay. I haven't, so I'm...
Right, and they're pretty smart guys. John Baumgartner invented the Terra computer system, which is the largest mainframe in the world at the time. And Harold Slusher was a professor at UTEP and University of Texas in El Paso. I know all these people. I've met them around other meetings, and they're bona fide, real-life PhD scientists that are experts in their field. John Baumgartner was like at Los Alamos for a long time, and... Russ Humphreys was at Sandia, and were in rather major positions of research. So they have, and there are other, let's see, who else is on the Great Commission? I can forget everybody.
Bob, you know any of this gentleman?
I know the name. I do not know the gentleman.
Okay. I'm just curious.
I just recommend Radioactivity and the Age of the Earth and a monograph by Harold Slusher called...
That's about wholly different radioactive.
Yeah, but the issue
about carbon.
No. It's exactly the issue you're having a problem with. It's the clock that's bad, not the shroud.
They've normalized carbon dating to bristletone pines for like 5,000 years, well within the range of the Shroud of Turin. So that doesn't really apply.
But pressure and temperature changes. We have two fires. And we have contamination from other wars.
Well, contamination could be an issue,
sure.
The problem is you need like 50% contamination.
Yeah. I think I've seen that statistic.
Okay. We have studied the change in radioactivity with temperature and pressure, and the change is almost negative. There is a change, and you can always say a delta, but it is very, very small. Now,
what about the Earth magnetic field? It's changing exponentially right now.
It's very slow.
Rapidly. It's very exponential.
I've been looking at magnetics for 20 years.
Okay, wait, one at a time. Bob's got the microphone, please.
I have to agree with what Joe said quite a while ago, what that is. We need to press on.
Let's get on with it.
And one of the things that has to come out of this conference, I think, is what if Turin people ask you for a statement of what we have accomplished at this meeting? And I think we need to have a statement, and we can't get caught up in all the minutiae.
Right.
So,
and even Meacham suggested that perhaps some statement could come from this conference. So I think that's
important. And I hope we can come up with a statement that said, look, we believe this, and it is based on actual data and experiments.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that nobody does experiments. All the experiments that people have done. Do not mistake that.
Okay.
The objective science has to go forward.
Don't
be intimidated by a clock. Might have here.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of hypothesizing, and boy, with the Shroud of Turin, you wouldn't believe over the years how many things I've heard that might or might not be an issue. So I think that it behooves us, at least those of us who approach it from a scientific point of view, to stay within science.
I'd like to suggest that science is only advanced by making observations. And if we don't move forward and make observations as professionally as possible, we're not going to learn anything new.
And even if we do, nobody's going to believe us when we say it.
Well, that's probably true.
If
it comes out well, then they won't believe it. And if it comes out badly, people won't believe it, so... But the point is, if you make good measurements, you document them, and you publish the results, you've done good science, and you're seeking the truth. And that's all anybody can ever expect right. of a scientist. We're not ideologues, hopefully. We're trying to find the truth objectively as best we can. And as long as we do that, I fail to see, you know, how... I mean, the chips fall where they may. When
that's
you're
right.
Doing.
Okay, we're gonna have something happen.
Okay.
Moving on, but just like the sample has got to be right this time, the test has got to be right this time.
Okay.
Well, said something that was.
Oh, you want me to?
No, the test has got to be. It's got to be right.
Okay.
The sample has to be credible. The sample has to.
And then it fell in on
right.
the head.
But it's obvious the sample has to be.
If Sue called up today to CBS and NBC says, "What we got a big announcement. We got a little. We got a thread we're going to test." They're going to say, "Who the hell are you guys?"
No.
So you agree it should be confidential?
Oh, they don't give a damn.
That's exactly right. Look, let me interrupt. Two things.
Let me just make the final point. I got interrupted.
I'm sorry.
The point is, the sample's got to be one we live or die with. The test has got to be right, and I'm taken by the comment over this gentleman over here. If the carbon dating of ancient cloths is inherently unreliable, we're better off not doing it. Is anybody here, do we have anybody here that's an expert on carbon dating of ancient linens? If not, is there such an expert? And shouldn't we take time to consult before we commit to that? Consult, and I just want the answer. Is ancient dating of, or carbon dating of ancient cloths, is it reliable? Because if it's not, maybe we should stay away from it.
What do you mean by reliable?
Okay.
A test reliable.
One at a time.
Don't ask too much.
One at a time.
Yeah.
Bob.
I'm an expert not in the accelerator mass spectrometer.
In the mic, Bob.
But in the chemical.
Bob, in the mic.
But.
No, you talk in it.
Well, okay.
Sorry.
All right. But I think this gentleman up here. We ought to listen to what he has to
right,
say.
Right, thank you. I was just going to say that. Julia just came up, so I think I'm just going to let Julia, because... Okay? So just bear witness to this, please. Go ahead, Julia.
You're all witnesses.
Okay, Bob, you come up here.
I must say that I give this shroud fibers in the name of Giovanni Ricci di Numana, who gave them to me for study. And his name must necessarily compare in every publication about this material.
Okay, now
hold on.
Okay, now you're
going to
have to hold that pose.
We're going to have to hold that pose.
Okay, now more than one. There you go. All right, good. Now we can say we really did something.
Yes.
And I just wanted to address one more point about what Larry was saying a moment ago, but I'm thrilled to see that we've actually really done something. Okay, Larry, I called my friend at CBS, where's Larry? I called my friend at Fox News, who have always been, by the way, a lot more amenable to the Shroud than the other networks, I have to admit. My friend at Fox News said to me when I said, I told him about this conference, the man said to me, could you have picked a worse time to have a conference with the Olympics and the elections? He said, but I do have a suggestion on how you can get media attention for the Shroud. Have Obama or McCain wear it. So the idea of getting media coverage for this kind of an event from the mainstream media is, I suggested to Sue that we get somebody with a rifle, put them on the top of the building and have them start shooting people, then we'll get good coverage. It seems to me that the media coverage these days is looking for drama. And this room may be experiencing a little drama here tonight, but not the kind of drama that the media is looking for, okay?
And I'm seriously thinking about writing an article called Miley
Miley Cyrus in the shroud. And meaning the first sentence, what do Miley Cyrus and the shroud have in common? Nothing, but I gotta get your attention.
Yeah.
Go there. I'm serious.
Or you could always substitute Britney Spears. Another possibility. Someone else. Somebody who hasn't yet expressed an opinion or asked a question. Because we still have about 15 minutes left, so there is room for. We don't. You're right. We don't have to go to 10 o'clock. Somebody said we did. Is there anyone else that has something to say? How about Rex, who hasn't said a word?
Well, yes, the reason I haven't said a word is because I know nothing about carbon-14 dating. And I don't know much about anything. But I have been involved in studying shroud and being involved in it for 30 years. And having listened to all the very fascinating discussion that's gone on, both in the main arena and in the sideshows, which you've interrupted some of it, I would like to make the following suggestion, that this conference determines that the Los Alamos Laboratory will be invited to test the reserve fiber as presented by Dr. Fanti. Oh, what's that? What do you got? Oh, you got the real thing? Sorry. All right, well, we get the terminology, right? That they test that piece, that fiber, so generously given by Dr. Fanti, and that they also test, what was the other thing that we wanted to test? A piece from Paul Maloney.
Right, Paul Maloney was going to provide
Paul Maloney was going to give us an old linen.
Thank you, Rex.
From whatever it was. And then we proceed with that.
Yeah.
I think the only question that's left is then what is to be done with the result? And is it to be confidential or is it not? And whatever the result is, what will be the consequences anyway?
Well, I think that the person who can answer the question of consequences best is probably Bob, who we've just handed these three samples to. But I think that, from my personal opinion, I'm just voicing in a personal opinion now, this isn't not even a suggestion, that I think it's wise to keep the information confidential until we have some sense of whether he's able to obtain data, whether they're able to obtain something that's viable, that repeatable, testable, that he can rely on with enough confidence to present to us with the confidence that he presented the earlier data in the afternoon today. But as far as confidentiality goes, you know, so much in the world of the shroud has been steeped in secrecy, and it's never done it any good.
Correct.
STIRP was out in the open at the beginning, but pretty much shortly thereafter, I remember getting chased down the street in Turin by Life magazine. Now, I'm a photographer, you know. I don't want Life to have to chase me. I would love to stop and talk to him. We were forbidden to talk to the media. Now, I think that was a grave mistake on the part of STIRP, and I believe they mismanaged their own public relations. But, you know, if you don't throw the dog a bone, the dog will dig under the fence and come and bite you. And that's what happened to STIRP. We could have every day issued a silly little press release that said, we're still working on it, we're taking more data, and give them something. So I think that the idea of secrecy, look what it's done for Turin. Turin has put themselves into this secret mode, and it's not been good for the Shroud or for the rest of the world, I don't think. So I think that the idea of qualified data done by qualified people, done on qualified technology by, you know, with people who are not Shroudies, sorry, that's what we're called, I don't see any reason why that has to be kept secret after proper testing has been done. What do you think, Joe?
I think it's probably unrealistic to think it's going to be kept secret.
Right.
I'm sorry, I'll repeat that. It's
Please.
Unrealistic to keep
right.
these kinds of secrets.
Right.
It's pretty sensational. It's
yeah, and I just don't think that the secrecy does any good. I mean, look, what is there to hide? If it's good data, you publish it. If it's bad data, you throw it away and you move on and you do something else, right?
The problem with keeping that information from, like, look, you know, because I was involved in that, is what happened was that if you didn't tell them anything, they just made it up.
Exactly. So you throw the dog the bone.
And I'm not kidding.
I know.
Press thrives on two things. One is controversy.
Hey.
And the other one is sensational.
There's a tabloid in England that wrote a story I was interviewed by a guy who wrote a story for an American paper. It showed up 3 months later in a British tabloid, and it said that I had given up my religion, forsaken my family, and had accepted Jesus, which was reasonably news to me. And so the real funny, and there was a photo of me, and my mother saw it. My mother happened to buy, see it, and bought a copy of it, and I was like, oh my gosh. I called my mother and said, oh, have you seen that? She goes, yeah, it's a great picture of you. She didn't even read it. She didn't care what it said. That was her son. In the... So the point is, you know, we suffer from a lot of media coverage of the wrong stuff. And I just personally believe that I have, look, I put myself on the line every time I write something, particularly an editorial or a review of something out on my website. So I really am careful when I'm writing it to say, okay, can I live with this for the rest of my life? Because I will have to. But I don't think there should be any shame in our doing good science and making it public. So I'm all for it.
Now,
can I get an amen?
Amen.
All right, I've always wanted to say that. Okay. Is there anything else for anyone? Should we do the line from Blazing Saddle? Meeting is adjourned. It is.
Explore the mystery at ShouteUniversity.com.